You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello everyone, this is Youssef. In today's episode, I'm going to pose two questions that I think you might have heard at least once, and try to provide answers. Also, we will listen to a small part of a song by the Egyptian diva, Kulthum. And I will remind you with the details of my upcoming lecture tomorrow, Understanding Palestine, lecture number 43. So let's get started. If somebody says to you, what is it to you as an Australian, as a non-Palestinian, not even non-Arab or non-Muslim, to support Palestine? Why do we have to bring to Australia a foreign cause? Why do we single out a particular cause when the world is filled with injustices in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, and in Europe, and bring to Australia a conflict that is far away, not relevant, and extremely complicated? Here is my answer to this. In every era, in every 10 years or so, the world has a moral test. For example, one of the most important moral tests in the 70s was Vietnam. So whether or not you are an American or Vietnamese, you have to have a position for you to identify as a progressive or as a person who cares about the morality, cares about the ethics. In the 80s, the moral test was South Africa, and you couldn't detach yourself from South Africa, struggle for independence and end of apartheid, especially in the 80s. And Palestine is the moral test of our time. Palestine has become the test where you can actually tell if the person is progressive, like they say, or like they prefer to say or identify, if they are honest, or if they are hypocrite. And let me explain. Within the progressive movement in Australia and around the world, particularly in the West, there is a set of values that governs this progressive camp. For example, you have to have a progressive position on climate change, and you take a position for change, to do something about global warming, and also to try and combat the voices that deny global warming and call it a scam. You also would see that there is a position, a progressive view on the rights of minorities, whether these minorities are the LGBTQ or migrant minorities or religious minorities, and you defend their rights to express their faith, their views safely in public sphere, and you support these minorities to have equal rights. And of course, you have also a position, strong view, to support the rights of Indigenous Australians and Indigenous groups around the world. And here we've seen a shift in the public view about Indigenous Australians and First Australians, First Nations, in the last 10 or 20 years. And Palestine has become one of these values. However, because of the lobby, because of the pro-Israel lobby, there is pushback to exclude Palestine from this set of values, even within the progressive voices. And that's why you would see people who have progressive views on climate change and minorities, and they do something to combat Islamophobia and combat fascism, and they support the rights of indigenous people. But when it comes to Palestine, they are either silent or even worse, pro-Israel. And this is why sociologists have come up with a term called PEP, progressive, except on Palestine. You can Google this term, PEP, progressive, except Palestine, and you'll see even Wikipedia page on it and the resources on it. Point is, Palestine has become the moral test, where you are held to your own values of being progressive, and you cannot continue to claim that you are progressive if you deny the genocide in Gaza, and if you don't want to do anything about the occupation of Palestinian lands, and if you directly or indirectly support the Zionist narrative. And I'm sure you know someone, somewhere, in your circles, at work, or a friend who is a PEP. And apart from the individuals, our institutions, whether state or federal, there is a room for being progressive and multiculturalism and pretending to be very progressive on human rights. But the last 2 years have exposed them. And I'm not talking about all of them, because some of them have really proven their sincerity and honesty, but the majority of organizations in Victoria and in Australia chose the safe and cowardly pathway, which is to remain silent on genocide and to impose self-censorship, because Palestine is just... The moment you mention the P word, the Palestine word, some alarm bells go off. And therefore, you choose to be intimidated by choice and become a PEP. So why Palestine? Because Palestine is the moral test of our time. Because we choose not to be complicit. Because we choose, we aspire to be moral, to adhere to morality. And indeed, Palestine is the moral test of our time. You're listening to Palestine Remembered on 855 AM. And I've chosen a song for Umm Kulthum, عودت عيني على رؤياك, a song that dates back to early 50s maybe, and it was composed by Riyad Sumbati. عودت عيني by Umm Kulthum. Let's listen to the first stanza. Umm Kulthum sang for nearly 5 decades in the 20th century. The last 3 decades of her life, she was the one and only, the most important and famous artist, not just singer, in Egypt and also in the Arab world. Not only did Umm Kulthum become a symbol for Arabic music and Arab arts and Arab singing and tarab, which is the musical ecstasy, she also was a symbol of Egypt, a symbol of the political project, the soft power of Jamal Abdel Nasser in the 50s and 60s. and symbol of Pan-Arabism, and also the ambassador of Arab arts to the Mediterranean and to the world. Even though she sang entirely in Arabic language, but she's a well-known figure in France, in Greece, in Turkey, in Iran, and in many other places that do not speak Arabic. I want to tell you one little story about that. In 2013, I went to the Greek consulate here in Melbourne, and as I was in the waiting room waiting to be served, I was just watching Greek television, and then I saw Umm Kulthum on Greek television in English, in Greek language, and turns out that it was her passing anniversary in February. So her passing anniversary is a news item in Greek television. As soon as Umm Kulthum started her career in Egypt, she knew she needed to go to Syria and Palestine for the rest of the Arab people to know her. She needed to go to Jaffa, the bride of the Mediterranean, the hub of arts and culture in the 40s. And in Jaffa, it was a Palestinian woman who was fascinated by her voice that called her, "You are Kawkab al-Sharq. You are the star of the East." And since then, that became her title. So Umm Kulthum is mentioned by name or by title. And one of her titles is Kawkab al-Sharq, which was given to her by a Palestinian woman from Jaffa before Nakba. This tells you that the Palestinian society was so advanced and so vivid and so diverse, and we were on our way to embrace modernity and remain, of course, adherent to our values, cultural values, until Britain and the Zionist movement brought their evil projects to our land and imposed new realities upon us. Another question that you might face when you talk about the genocide and you want to focus about the killing of children and women and civilians and the violation of human rights against the Palestinian people is, this is the Palestinian version of the story. This is the Palestinian narrative. We should listen to both narratives to form a rational view. While I think this sounds like a good idea, but it carries a trap, and it's not coming from a good intention, because there is no such thing called the narrative of the victim versus the narrative of the oppressor. So beware of falling into this trap, because this is an attempt to dilute the realities on ground, and always go back to the word, the key word, reality. Reality.
Hi, this is Rafif Ziada, and you're listening to 3CR, pro-Palestinian, happily proud radio.
The Palestinian population around the world is 14 million. Each and every one of the Palestinians in Palestine, under occupation from the river to the sea or around the world, live under one of six realities imposed by Israel with no regard to our will. And depending where we are, there's Israel tailored and crafted a particular political and economic and military reality and imposed it on us. So the first reality is the reality of the people in Gaza, and it affects 2.2 million Palestinians, and it's the reality of blockade and siege. And while the tightened siege and blockade is strongly held, Israel keeps visiting Gaza militarily with waves of hostilities in 2006, in 2008/9, 2012, 2014, 2021, and the worst of the worst of the worst of the worst, was after 2023 and the genocide, which also included the famine and a long list of other atrocities against this finite group of people, 2.2 million Palestinians. So that's the first reality. The second reality is the reality in West Bank, which affects 3.2 million Palestinians who live in an area of 5,800 square kilometers. And they live, the reality there is direct military occupation. So it's a bad reality. It's a terrible one, but it's different bad to the reality of the people in Gaza. And what Israel wants of Gaza is different to what it wants from West Bank. In West Bank, Israel wants to continue looting its natural resources, especially water, because West Bank is rich in its aquifers. It also wants to keep importing settlers and planting illegal settlers on stolen Palestinian land. Now we have nearly 1 million of them. Also, it wants to prevent Palestinians from realizing their self-determination to prevent a state, to prevent the Palestinian from having a state. And also, it wants to convert a group of the population there into cheap labor inside Israel and even inside the settlements on stolen land in the West Bank. And also, it has turned West Bank into a laboratory for its weapons and technology. The people of West Bank are the most surveilled group of people on this planet. There's camera every second corner. Every house, every apartment has an ID in the database of the Israeli army. We are extremely scrutinized and surveilled. So the reality in the West Bank is the reality of violence from two sources, from the soldiers and from the settlers. Because the settlers, if you think of the settlers live in a neighborhood, then you're wrong. Most of them are armed to the teeth. At least one quarter of them or one third of them is ideological settlers, where they think they have a sacred duty to expel the Palestinians from their land. And they keep referring to biblical reasons why they should do that. And to make it even more painful for Palestinians, they divided the West Bank into blocks with checkpoints, permanent checkpoints, temporary checkpoints, and more painfully, Israel, since 2003, has constructed a separation wall that it calls a security fence. Now that this wall is taller than the infamous Berlin Wall, and it cuts through Palestinian lands, and it separates families and communities and farmers from their agricultural lands, and it adds more pain to the Palestinian wound, more salt to the Palestinian injury. So the reality of any Palestinian in Ramallah, Nablus, Tul Karim, Jenin, Ariha, Al-Khalil is a reality of direct military occupation. Now let's go to the third reality, the reality of Al-Quds, Jerusalem. While Jerusalem was occupied in the same time of West Bank, but Israel had different plan for Jerusalem because it wanted to annex it since day one. And the reality there is the reality of, yes, direct military occupation, but the ultimate object, the ultimate goal that Israel wants to achieve from Al-Quds is Judaization, de-Arabization. Less Palestinians, less whether they are Muslims or Christians, and more Jewish settlers. Let's flip the demography. And how Israel is trying to achieve that is by a silent, slow, painful series of laws and laws and laws and regulations to turn the lives of the Palestinians in Jerusalem into hell. These measures are municipality measures, anything and everything that includes the garbage collection, the size of school classes, the length of red light on traffic lights, everything. You just think of anything and you will find there is something for the Palestinians and another thing for the settlers. In addition to security measures and punishment measures by the security, by the police, by the army, and the kind of paperwork that Israel gave the Palestinians of Jerusalem, they gave them Israeli travel documents that do not lead to citizenship. So it's perpetual. You're perpetually in a temporary situation. Where are the Palestinians of West Bank? They were holders of Jordanian passports and now Palestinian Authority passports and IDs. So the reality in Jerusalem is the reality of Judaization. And also the nature of the settlement project in Jerusalem is different to its to it is in the West Bank. In addition to occupying top of the hills, like Ma'ali Adumim settlement, Jerusalem settlements is enclaved, Al-Istitan Al-Jaybi, where Israel occupies a building in a suburb, an apartment in a building, a rooftop of an apartment, and they put the white and blue flag and they claimed it. And they put around it security forces and just turned the lives of the inhabitants into hell and constant nightmare. So the third reality is the reality of Jerusalem, which is Judaization. And the fourth reality, it affects the Palestinian holders of Israeli passports. Here we're talking about Israeli citizens of Palestinian origin. Here we're talking nearly 2 million of the Israeli citizens. And it's the reality of marginalization. They are fifth-class citizens after the Ashkenazis, after the Mizrahis, after the Russians, the Ukrainians, after the Falasha / Ethiopian African Jews. And then comes the Arabs. And the Arabs, whether or not you serve in the army, then there's a hierarchy. So it's marginalization and discrimination, even though that they are supposedly citizens. But even according to Israeli constitution and laws, they made the nation bill, where they made a distinction between being a citizen and being a member of the nation. And because you belong to the wrong religion, so you don't get to choose, you don't get to exercise right of self-determination, because you are not a member of the nation, and the nation has to be the Jewish nation. So that's the fourth reality. And the fifth reality is affecting the refugees. That's more than half of the population, and they made us refugees in Nakba time, and they call us absentees, and they deny our return, and they confiscate our properties. My mother's grandfather's house in Safad is stolen, and there are two Jewish families live in our very same house that my grandfather lived in, or even was born in Safad in the north. So the fifth reality, it affects the Palestinian refugees, is the reality of denial of return and refusing to even talk about our right of return. And the sixth reality is where the Palestinians get to meet a Palestinian from Jerusalem or from 48 or from West Bank or Gaza, or refugee get to meet. And that's the reality of prisoners. Only behind bars we get to see each other. So do not be intimidated and do not be tricked into the Palestinian narrative versus the Israeli narrative. No, there is no such thing called narrative of the oppressor versus the narrative of the victim. It's the reality. Let's talk about the realities that Israel imposes on all of the Palestinians.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.